WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Richard Gere talks about his movies, how acting relates to practicing Buddhism, and how he got banned from presenting at the Academy Awards. And we'll talk about his new film, The Hoax, based on the true story of Clifford Irving, who conned his publisher into believing he was the authorized biographer of the reclusive and eccentric mogul Howard Hughes. Also, screenwriter and director Jake Kasdan talks about his new film comedy, The TV Set, about a writer making a TV pilot. Kasdan is familiar with the absurdities his character faces. Kasdan directed the pilots for Freaks and Geeks and the short-lived Undeclared. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Richard Gere, has starred in such films as Looking for Mr. Goodbar, Days of Heaven, American Gigolo, An Officer and a Gentleman, Pretty Woman, Unfaithful, and Chicago. His new film, The Hoax, is based on the true story of an infamous publishing hoax. In 1971, the writer Clifford Irving claimed to have gotten permission from the reclusive and eccentric mogul Howard Hughes to become Hughes' authorized biographer. Irving negotiated a six-figure advance from his publisher and eventually handed in a manuscript he said was based on interviews with Hughes. But Irving never had any contact with Hughes. None. How Irving managed to write the book and pass it off to his publisher as the real thing, getting deeper and deeper into his lies, is the subject of The Hoax. In this scene, Clifford Irving is discussing the scam with his friend and collaborator, who is skeptical they'll get away with it. The friend is played by Alfred Molina.
A man walks in, he says something completely implausible, and for that exact reason, he's believed. No, it's an Aquarian phenomenon. Very, very spiritual.
Lawyers are not spiritual. Presumably this is going to make news. Howard Hughes hasn't spoken to the press in 15 years.
What are you so nervous about? You can't think, Dick. No thinking.
All I'm saying is, once this gets out, what's going to stop this guy from suing our asses off? Have you heard of Intertel? He has his own private CIA. Ruthless advisors.
His advisors don't know anything about the book because he's too paranoid to tell them. And he'll never come out of hiding long enough to denounce me because he's a lunatic hermit. And I am the spokesperson for the lunatic hermit. So the more outrageous I sound, the more convincing I am.
I talked with Richard Gere about his impressions of Clifford Irving, who Gere portrays in The Hoax.
If you read his fake autobiography, which is probably the best thing he's ever written, it's really quite beautiful and quite touching. And it starts off with an answer to a question. The question is, why would Howard Hughes ask me to do this, of all the writers in the world? And he goes into an evaluation of his own writing. He calls himself a journeyman writer, and he goes into his background. And it is really kind of beautiful writing. And he finds this psychological, emotional, spiritual kinship with Howard Hughes as only children and young men who had lost their fathers when they were teenagers. And there was a kind of mental, emotional, aesthetic points of view that they had in common. And much of that I took in the work that I did on the movie.
So Clifford Irving is still alive. Did you want to talk with him?
I didn't when we were shooting. And it was a very conscious decision that you know, we were not making a documentary about him. And he's clearly, I make the assumption that he's a very manipulative guy. And frankly, I just didn't want to be in a position to be concerned about his feelings about this. Nor did I want his point of view, really. I had a very clear point of view from the script and all the research material. And I had enormous respect for him, you know, and really came to like him, actually. Very fond of him, the character that I knew. But I really didn't want that influence. In fact, I just talked to him about 10 days ago for the first time.
Why did you talk to him?
Well, I felt it was time.
Uh-huh.
You know, the movie's finished, and you know, it felt like the right thing to do.
Had he seen
this
it?
Was, yeah.
What did he have to say about it?
You can imagine a bunch of strangers making a movie about you. Now, do you think they're going to get it all right? Highly unlikely. So he was very sensitive with me on the phone about this, but I know there's stuff that he had problems with. And I assured him, I said, look, Clifford, this is not a documentary. And obviously you've seen the movie, so we're after, in some ways, much larger game than just the story of this aspect of your life. We're going after Nixon, we're going after Watergate, we're going after the Vietnam War, we're going after a lot of things with this movie.
I'd like to talk about your movie career with you, starting from your pre-movie career when you got the leading role of Danny Zuko in the London production of Grease. And I find it so interesting that you started in a musical and you were in Chicago, which is like such a great film. And that was really recently. So many years later, you were in a musical again. Did you ever intend or expect your career to start with a musical?
Well, it didn't really. I mean, I left college when I was, it was after my sophomore year, and I had auditioned and received an offer to be at the Provincetown Playhouse in Cape Cod. And I left school to do that, and one thing led to another, and I was then in the Seattle Repertory Theater for a season, and then I left that, and I had a rock band for a little while, and then I decided I was going to go become an actor. And I came to New York, and it was an interesting time. It was the late 60s. It was about this time, 1970 maybe, when I came to New York. And I had long hair, and I had I could sing and dance and play guitars and keyboards and things, and rock musicals were happening. And the first audition I did was a rock musical. It wasn't Grease. It was another show called Soon. And I got that job, and that kept me floating for a while. And I think there was another musical after that about Richard Farina that I did.
Mm-hmm.
And then a couple of other plays, and then the Grease job came up, which I really enjoyed. I was an understudy in New York. I covered like five or six parts. And then had this offer to go to open it in London, which was a big move for me. You know, for a young actor to go to the West End and in a very successful show there was a great growing, expanding experience for me, no doubt about it.
So when you were in Chicago a couple of years ago in the movie adaptation mm-hmm. of the musical,
I have forgotten how much fun it was, to tell you the truth.
How much fun a musical is?
Oh, yeah. It had been 30 years since I did a musical,
mm-hmm.
and I had really forgotten just how much fun, especially good material with, you know, a terrific script. Bill Condon wrote that script mm-hmm. for Chicago, and Rob Marshall, of course, the director. It was just about the most fun I've ever had as an actor.
Had you been singing, like, at home in the intervening years, or did you feel like you had to brush up with singing lessons?
No, music has been a full-time part of my life, my whole life. So that's always there. But we had a wonderful vocal coach on that we all came from different traditions. Catherine Zeta-Jones is an incredible voice, but she is not necessarily a Broadway kind of voice. Mine is not a Broadway kind of voice. It's more of a rock voice. So we all were taking training to sing this kind of stuff.
What did you learn about your voice through that training?
Well, I learned how to not strain it so much, actually. I learned how to get off of it a little bit, which, in fact, has made it stronger.
Well, while we're talking about Chicago, why don't we hear you performing in the role from the soundtrack? And I thought we'd play All I Care About. And we should say here that you're a lawyer who really is in it for, like, the money and the fame, and you're singing about how all you really care about is love. Here it is, Richard Gere from the soundtrack of Chicago.
I don't care about expensive things. Cashmere coats, diamond rings don't mean a thing. All I care about is love. That's what I'm here for. I don't care for wearing silk cravats, ruby studs, satin spats don't mean a thing. All I care about is love. Give me two eyes of blue, softly saying, let me see her standing there. And honest mister, I'm a millionaire. I don't care for any fine attire Vanderbilt might admire. No, no, not me. All I care about is love.
That's Richard Gere from the soundtrack of Chicago. He's now starring in The Hoax. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Richard Gere, and he plays Clifford Irving in the new movie, The Hoax. I want to ask you about American Gigolo, which was written and directed by Paul Schrader, and you play a very high-class escort in this who's hired by mostly wealthy older women.
The word now is a sex worker.
Yes.
That's
thank you.
That's the international term.
Yes, and you're often hired by older women who are visiting and who either want a thrill or just want to be desired, particularly desired by somebody who's really attractive.
Beyond that, even if you really look at the root of it, it's just treated well.
Uh huh.
Someone
uh-huh.
they just want to be treated well. Someone uh-huh. to notice them.
Let me play a short scene. This is a scene from early on where you're in. It's like a restaurant or a hotel bar, and you're glancing at an older woman. Played by a slightly older woman, played by Lauren Hutton. You think she wants to hire you, and she doesn't realize you're a pro, and she's flattered by your attention. So here's the scene from American Gigolo.
Why did you come on to me?
Like I said, I made a mistake. I heard you speaking French. Often in these big hotels, you run into women from foreign countries who may need a translator or a guide.
And they hire you.
Yes.
How many languages do you speak?
Five or six.
Plus the international language.
That's right.
So that's Lauren Hutton and my guest Richard Gere in a scene from American Gigolo. Did you realize when you made this scene the ways in which it was going to resonate culturally? And I think one of the ways it resonated culturally was just in terms of, I think the most iconic scene in the movie is like when you're taking your clothes out of the closet and of the drawers and you're laying them out on the bed.
That was so far beyond me. First of all, I don't think I even owned a suit at that point. And this was all Paul Schrader.
Mm-hmm.
Paul had this thing about, I think he called it the new dandyism, and he was very prescient about this. It was Giorgio...
Moroder.
Giorgio
Armani. Giorgio Moroder did the music. And
he did the
music,
who I just also
Giorgio
just
Armani
saw
did the
last
clothes.
Week also, yeah. And I haven't seen him since then.
Armani or Moroder?
Moroder.
Uh-huh.
And so Armani, it was very stylized clothes, and this whole thing about shirts and picking out a tie that went with the shirt and
uh-huh.
the thing and all. I mean, this was a total construct. I didn't know anything about this, but I went with it and I said, okay, let's give this a try.
It's funny that the movie didn't become famous as like a crime story. It became famous.
No, it's about style.
Yes, yeah,
you know,
exactly.
Movie was,
it became famous for style. Yeah.
But that's what it was, really.
Mm-hmm,
it
mm-hmm.
really was about two-dimensional realities, magazine realities,
mm-hmm.
you know, and a kind of tendency, especially in the West, to see things in surfaces.
Now, had you seen Taxi Driver, which Paul Schrader wrote before you made
sure.
American Gigolo?
Of course.
They seem to come from such like different places in his mind. But did Taxi Driver help you in any way in understanding where he was coming from?
Well, he had already done his own movie, Blue Collar, I believe, at that point,
mm-hmm.
which he wrote and directed. But Paul was, I mean, it was enough known, you could see where the guy was coming from, that he wanted to do some adventurous work and stylish work. You know, even as rough as Taxi Driver was, as gritty, it's very stylish. Its use of music, its use of visuals, its cutting style, it's very stylish. It has a very visceral, gritty energy to it. But, you know, Paul's a classicist and a great structuralist. There's probably no one better in the business at structuring a story in an interesting way than Paul Schrader.
You know, you said that he saw this movie as being about the new dandy. And there's a scene early on where you're working out, hanging upside down from your ankles while lifting hand weights. And I think it's like one of the early times in a movie when somebody's working out for kind of glamour abs as opposed to because like they're a tough guy or they're a weightlifter or something.
Yeah, those boots. I haven't seen them since then. But yeah, I mean, this was Paul's idea, which was way ahead of its time, of people being sucked into two-dimensional surface realities.
Mm-hmm.
With the body, with the clothes, with the hair, with the right sunglasses, with the walk, with the... It's all about presentation without substance. So you see this guy systematically being stripped of all style, all surface, and ends up in jail, leaning up against a glass window where he touches the girl through the window. They put hands up against glass. It's someone who has to start from ground zero and actually build a human being now instead of a Cupid doll.
I'm so glad that you describe this as being a movie about people who are sucked up in two-dimensional realities, because that kind of answers the question that I was going to ask you. You know, most people know that you've been, practicing and studying Buddhism for many years. And, of course, you know, the kind of, you know, narcissism and materialistic culture that the character in American Gigolo represents is exactly what Buddhism is about not doing. It's about kind of transcending. Go ahead.
I'm thinking of a scene in the movie that actually is the opposite of that. And mm-hmm. you can't play these things and you can't be two-dimensional playing a two-dimensional person. You have to be three. You have to show the possibility of three plus dimensions
mm-hmm.
and that it's been squeezed into two in the story. But there's a scene in there, as I recall, where he's surfacing a woman, and I think her husband has paid me to do this, and he wants to watch. And she's very, she's nauseated by this. And if I'm remembering the scene, I just tell her it's all right, just relax and forget about him. And I was just very nice with her, very gentle and, in his way, sensitive with her. And within his own structure, he's a mensch. Now, in terms of the world and what's legal and what isn't, he's a bad guy. But within what he does, he is there to provide a service in a very real way and takes it very seriously. And those are real human moments in the movie.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Were you already interested in Buddhism then?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've been practicing since my early 20s.
You know, I know that you know the Dalai Lama, and he's pretty famous for different reasons, of course, but you've had to learn how to deal with fame. I wonder if watching him and how he deals with his own kind of fame has been interesting and valuable for you.
It's had enormous impact on me. I don't know any actor or artist or anyone else who, by inclination, wants the negative side of being famous, which is the lack of privacy, the sense of being in a fishbowl. Nobody wants that. And I see His Holiness go through that his whole life, since he was 2 years old when he was discovered. And the incredible patience and grace that he deals with that was enormously instructive to me, that every interaction was a possibility for compassion, for love, for transformation.
I read that you were banned as an Academy Award presenter back in around 1993. While presenting an award, you used it as an opportunity to condemn the Chinese government for the occupation of Tibet.
It was slightly different than that.
Yeah, explain what happened, because I just read about it.
I wasn't condemning. I mean, I certainly told the truth, but my approach is not... I'm inclusive. Any system that is exclusive is doomed to failure. So my whole thing with the Chinese is that for them to do the right thing is good for them. For them to do the wrong thing is bad for them. Forgetting everyone else. If you have any concern for the Chinese, they're creating a horrendous future for themselves by being not compassionate and being bad in the present. So my approach with them is really just to encourage them to be the best government, the best people that they can be, and to treat everyone else like brothers and sisters.
But anyway, so you use the Academy Awards as an opportunity to say something
sure,
about
absolutely.
China. Were you warned beforehand not to do that, or did they explain why they banned you afterwards?
I don't know why. I mean, obviously I spoke, and the powers that be were not pleased, which was okay with me.
Was the orchestra trying to play you off as you spoke?
No, I don't think they were. I think I went into some slightly mad monologue about something similar to what I just said, and then I presented some award. I even forget what it is now. What it was, but it was, there are 6 million Tibetans inside of Tibet. There's about 150,000 Tibetans who've gotten out, and they need our help.
And just one more thing on this. Did you get a letter saying, "Dear Richard Gere, you'll never again present on this stage"? how did they let you know?
No, they told my agent. They said, "He will never, ever, ever be on this stage again." So,
Richard Gere will be back in the second half of the show. He's starring in the new film, The Hoax. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of The Pilgrim's Progress by John Bunyan, in stores and online at bn.com. And from the Pew Charitable Trusts, helping states protect public safety, hold offenders accountable, and control the cost of corrections at pewpublicsafety.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
The new movie, The TV Set, is a comedy about a writer making a TV pilot forced to make ridiculous compromises. Coming up, we talk with the screenwriter and director of The TV Set, Jake Kasdan. He directed the pilots of Freaks and Geeks and Undeclared. And we continue our conversation with Richard Gere.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Richard Gere. His new film, The Hoax, is based on an infamous publishing hoax from 1971 when Clifford Irving passed himself off as Howard Hughes's authorized biographer. I want to get back to, you know, some of your films. I read that when you were young, you loved the Hercules films and, you know, like the Samson and Delilah kind of stuff where there's like this strong man.
I did. I always loved that. And I don't know exactly why. I think it was just because it was myth,
mm-hmm.
the power
mm-hmm.
of myth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't about words. It was about, who was the,
Steve Reeves?
Gustave Moreau. Okay.
Sorry.
Is he the great engravist? It is Gustave Moreau, I believe, who did wonderful, epic engravings. There was something about that touched me. I think probably still does. I like to see just kind of mythic representations of what we are and maybe who we really are.
I was thinking about the distance between that myth, like the Hercules myth, and the kind of mythic representation in, say, Pretty Woman, which is this like romance myth. You know, of like,
mm-hmm.
you know, the hooker and the tycoon who are both kind of in the same business in some way, but they find this kind of good essence within each other and have plenty of money and when they hook up. It's such a different kind of myth than the Hercules one. Did you feel like you could connect with that one, with the romance myth?
I wasn't a believer myself when that movie came up, and I didn't get it at all. And the reality was, someone who I did respect basically talked me into looking at it over and over again, and I still didn't get it until I met Gary Marshall, who directed it. And Gary's an especially good heart, and there is something truly delightful and wonderful about Gary. And Gary, you know, we didn't even talk about the movie that much, but I had a feeling that Gary's heart was going to end up on screen. And there's a real truth to him. I mean, it's not about the money. It's not about the jobs. It's about two people being, in the end, fundamentally honest with themselves and each other about who they are. And they weren't cool. You know, when we're not cool is when people fall in love with us, correct? When we're just ourselves and we're a bit goofy and...
This is what we really hope anyways.
Well, it's always true in my life.
Uh-huh,
you know, every
uh-huh.
time that the stuff, the idea of us is dropped, the idea of you and me is dropped, then there's the possibility of really seeing what's there. And usually there's just a human being and there's something delightful and what's the word?
Vulnerable.
Yeah, for sure, vulnerable. But it's nutritious
mm-hmm.
to the soul. It's nutritious to our hearts to see a human being.
So you did this movie without believing in it?
Well, once you get into something, of course, you make it that. And we worked very hard to, within the structure of what it was and in the style that it was, to find a human truth there. Again, the style is a very romantic style. This is not a gritty movie. You know, she's not a gritty hooker. You know, this is a Disney hooker.
Mm-hmm. So after you made this movie that you didn't quite get, did everybody want to cast you in their version of that same kind of movie that you wouldn't quite get?
Well, I think everyone tried to make that movie. Everyone thought it was easy. You know, people think that kind of a movie is easy, and it's not. It's lightning in a bottle. And, you know, everyone tried to make basically the same movie, and I think they all failed.
No,
I think we even tried to make a movie after that, Julie and I, which wasn't nearly as good.
Which one was that?
Runaway Bride.
Oh, right, sure. Now, An Officer and a Gentleman, another movie that kind of struck some kind of chord, particularly because of that last scene where you walk into the place mm. where Deborah Winger's working, and you literally like pick her up and sweep her off the feet, and everybody applauds. And mm-hmm. it's like, How many times is that going to happen in real life?
Well, I remember.
But it struck this chord, yeah.
Well, there was this Bernardo Bertolucci was a friend of mine then, and we were talking about doing another movie, and he said he'd seen Officer and Gentleman. He said, "I like the movie very much, but I said the ending is very fascist," and I kind of let it go. And then he said something else like that, and I went, "Wait a minute, what do you mean fascist?" He said, "Well, you know, when the army comes in the factory and the workers applaud." So there was an element of that. I never thought it would work, and I cautioned the director. Said, "Let's we don't have much money. Let's cut this scene and shoot something else that we know is going to be in the movie." And he said, "I know it's probably not, but let's shoot it anyway." So we did it full out, and everyone, you know, filled it with the emotions that were required. And I still was kind of skeptical, although it was a gas shooting it. You know, it was kind of a rush shooting the scene, coming into this factory of women workers. And, you know, I had that vanilla ice cream naval suit on and picked her up like Sir Galahad. And I never thought it would work. And frankly, it wasn't working great until Taylor got the right music under it. And then he found the right rhythm, the perfect rhythm for that music. And it, even for me, it worked.
What was the music? I don't remember what the music was.
It was the theme music of It's Up, Up Where You Belong. It was that music. It was the instrumental version of that. Which had been my theme music for the whole movie. But he found the right tempo that was almost the tempo of a heart beating.
So do you finally think it works?
Yeah, no, I do. Now, why they work, I'm not sure. It's magic. I don't know. You can't make those things happen.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Enjoyed it.
Richard Gere is starring in the new film, The Hoax. Coming up, a new movie comedy about a TV pilot. This is Fresh Air.
Love is up where we belong, where the eagles cry on the mountain high. Love is up where we belong, far from the world below, where the clear winds blow.
It must be pretty exciting to write a TV pilot that is getting produced. But according to the new movie comedy, The TV Set, it can be pretty awful, too. Every step of the way, there's another compromise to make if you want the network executives to greenlight your series. My guest, Jake Kasdan, wrote and directed The TV Set. It stars David Duchovny as a writer whose TV pilot is being cast and produced. He intends it to be a dramedy about a young man who is, among other things, dealing with his brother's suicide. Here he is talking with several network executives, including the president of the network, who's played by Sigourney Weaver.
Should we talk about the script?
Yeah. There's a feeling among some of us. Is it absolutely necessary that the brother commit suicide?
Sorry?
It's just so sad.
Yeah, I never saw this as a suicide show. I see it more like a guy comes home, the town needs him kind of show. A little northern exposure, a little Ed.
You see, it's very personal to me because my brother killed himself. That's where all this came from. And, you know, the suicide, to me, has always been kind of the premise for everything that happens.
No, but let's just think about it for a second. What if it weren't?
Jake Kasdan knows about what can go wrong during the piloting process. He directed the pilots for Freaks and Geeks and Undeclared, as well as a pilot that was never broadcast. Kasdan grew up around movie sets. His father, Lawrence Kasdan, directed The Big Chill and Silverado. In Jake Kasdan's new movie, two actors audition for the leading role in the pilot. The more subtle actor, the writer's favorite, bombs. The one that is over the top wins the enthusiastic approval of the network executives. I asked Kasdan if he had a similar experience.
I've always, in fairness, ended up with somebody that I wanted, at least the vast majority of the time. But there is something about the way that they cast pilots that makes it difficult for a certain kind of acting and a certain kind of actor to be cast. And part of that, and what we sort of illustrate in the movie in detail, is that before a lead actor is cast in a television pilot, they have to audition for a room of like 25 executives. And the kind of acting that plays in a room like that, essentially a small, very cold theater, is different from the kind of acting that plays best, you know, when a camera is 6 inches from your face. So the person who does the bigger thing will often play better to the room. And I've had that happen before, where someone comes in and is kind of more obvious with jokes or the delivery of their line, and it, you know, plays to the back of the room, as they say, and they get the part where the quieter, subtler performance might not.
When you were auditioning actors for Freaks and Geeks, and you did the pilot of that in several episodes, so I'm assuming maybe incorrectly that you were in on the auditions.
Yeah, I was.
Were there executives who wanted like actors who looked like super geeky, like too much? You know, like who wanted like Napoleon Dynamite as opposed to an actor who would look like they would be the kind of high school kid who would be really self-conscious and uncomfortable, but not like crazily geeky?
There was a little bit of that. To be fair, Freaks and Geeks was a uniquely great creative experience, and we really were able to do pretty much exactly what we wanted without a lot of resistance. I think mostly because no one at the network believed that the show had a chance, and so there was some attitude that it probably wouldn't be around that long, so they would sort of let us do what we wanted. And at the pilot stage in particular, there was, I feel like what really happened is there was a sort of a corporate shakeup right before that pilot season at NBC, and there was sort of no one doing the job that Sigourney's character in the movie is doing, the network president who sort of has the controlling aesthetic. There was a little less of that kind of conversation at the pilot stage, at the casting stage, and the result is we got pretty much exactly the cast we wanted on the show, and made a pilot that people really seemed to respond to, but that was generally perceived to have very little chance commercially. And so that combination of having of being sort of loved by critics and perceived to be doomed in, as a standing series, somehow created a combination where they would sort of let us do what we wanted with the constant looming threat of cancellation.
Now, what I find really sad about this is Freaks and Geeks was really a terrific show, but it did get canceled. It never became popular, although it's developed quite a cult following from the broadcast and from the DVD release, but it never really did well on TV, and it didn't last long because of that. So, like, God, you know, maybe those network executives are right, you know, that you have, if you do think that's something that's like more subtle and more funny in a sophisticated way, that it's not going to work.
It won't reach the audience that, you know, the thing about making a television show for network television is that you have to reach such an enormous audience in order to justify staying on their air, you know, from a business point of view. So we were drawing, I think, 7 or 8 million people a week and were the lowest rated show on network television, really like number 99 or something on the Nielsen ratings. You know, they talk about it like there's just no one watching, but there were 8 million people and we were getting destroyed by cops every week. I mean, like, Not even close. My favorite one was there was one day where the ratings came back and we were in fourth place. And there had been a rain delay in a baseball game on Fox during the playoffs. And they had put on a rerun of America's Funniest Home Videos that had crushed us. And in the ratings, it said Freaks and Geeks had been blown out of the water by, it said on the ratings sheet, America's Funniest Rain Delay. So couldn't compete with America's Funniest Rain Delay.
You know, there's a lot of, like, corporate network speak on the part of some of the executives in the movie. My favorite line is the Sigourney Weaver character, who's the president of the network, says about one of the actresses being auditioned, "She doesn't let her cuteness get in the way of her hotness." Can you talk about writing that line, or did you actually overhear somebody say that?
I don't know if I've ever heard exactly that phrase, but it's the kind of thing that people talk about and debate with incredible seriousness in auditions. That's sort of embarrassing on the drive home. And also, it's the kind of conversation that as a writer or, you know, director, you can become involved in and find yourself debating their cuteness versus their hotness. See, I do feel like her cuteness gets in the way of her hotness. You can sort of get co-opted into the conversation a little bit more than you expect to. And, you know, which is also part of what the movie's about, is when the landscape is that way and when they've just made a lot more shows than you have, you know, a lot more. They're dealing with a lot more pilots at any moment than you are. And they just have a lot more experience. And especially, like, I was, you know, Freaks and Geeks was my first TV experience, and then I did some other stuff after that, but there is a part of you that always thinks, like, well, maybe they know something about this that I don't know, and there was a danger that her, you know, cuteness could get in the way of her hotness. So you hear that kind of thing a lot.
My guest is Jake Kasdan, director of the new film, The TV Set. Here's a scene from the pilot of Freaks and Geeks, which was directed by Kasdan. The series is about a group of kids in a Michigan high school and centers around a geeky freshman named Sam and his older sister, Lindsay, a smart girl who's friends with the kids in the Freak or Burnout clique. Sam is goofing around with his friends doing Bill Murray imitations when a bigger kid comes over and tries to rough him up until his sister intervenes.
Sam Weir, you really like Bill Murray, don't you?
Yeah, he's great.
Bill Murray, man.
No, he doesn't. He's cool.
Oh, really? What is he? Your boyfriend? Sam Queer? It's fighting time, Weird.
Leave me alone, Earl.
I'm sorry. I don't speak geek. I always wanted to know what it'd be like to fight a girl.
I'm a girl. Want to see what it'd be like to fight me?
Weird sister has to protect him.
I'm not protecting him. Just trying to figure out why it is you need to pick fights with guys who weigh less than 100 pounds.
Watch out, Ellen. I think she's high on pot.
Yeah, I might just go psycho on you. Want to try me?
You're dead, all right? As soon as your freak sister isn't around, I'm gonna cream you, man.
You know, you really didn't need to do that. I could have handled it.
Yeah, I know.
And by the way, I weigh 103 pounds.
Sorry. Man, I hate high school.
So how often did you hear when you were making pilots, or how often did your friends who made pilots hear, it's too depressing, that part of the story, so we have to change it?
All the time. I mean, it might be that I'm just drawn to material that people find depressing, but, I mean, that was the running conversation, certainly on Freaks and Geeks. The language that they would use a lot of the time is, you know, can't they have more victories? Can't these geeks have more victories? We want them to win. We want to see them win. Why can't they just once get the girl? And our thing, and Paul Feig, who, you know, it was his baby in a way, felt very strongly and was absolutely right that, no, not even once. It ceases to be the show that it is if the geeky little guy gets the cheerleader. And eventually we had heard it so many times that in that specific case, the goofy little geek kid getting the cheerleader, we eventually came up with a really Paul eventually came up with a really funny sort of morbid way for him to get the cheerleader, which is that he finally, after the whole season, kind of gets her attention for a minute, and they're dating as much as, you know, freshmen in high school can be dating, and, you know, people who can't drive. And he immediately realizes that she doesn't get any of the jokes, and he doesn't really like her that much, and ends up breaking up with her in the next episode. So it was sort of exactly the opposite of what the network had been requesting the whole time, which is that there could be a moment where our kids are happy. That's really what they're talking about is, you know, when they say victories, is like something we can celebrate at home. There's a little victory. They made it across the, you know, they made it into the end zone in some way or another. And, you know, what we always heard and what they in fact meant is this is depressing. And there was stuff like that on Undeclared throughout, certainly on the Zero Effect pilot. That was sort of a running issue there, too. Yeah, I'm always hearing that things are too depressing.
Well, you know, you're talking about the pilots of Freaks and Geeks. There is a kind of semi-victory moment, like one of the geeky kids asked the taller, really pretty girl to dance at the prom. And she
accepts. Yeah, he gets his one dance. That's right.
Well, no, but the thing is, you know, it's like a slow dance. And he takes this long walk with her across the far end of the dance floor. And just as he holds out his arms for her to dance, like, the band changes into something up-tempo. And, of course, he can't dance fast. So it's really, like, humiliating for him, although he does end up dancing fast.
Yeah. That's the kind of victory that we liked. Like, very small victories with a lot of conditions on them and some large comic conceit that makes it a little bit embarrassing and funny.
My guest is Jake Kasdan. His new movie is The TV Set. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jake Kasdan, and he wrote and directed the new film, The TV Set, which stars David Duchovny as a television writer who's in the process of auditioning and shooting a pilot for a new series that he's proposed. Now, you're speaking to us now from the soundstage of the movie that you're making, and the movie that you're making now is, from what I've read, a satire of music biopics like Walk the Line, the movie about Johnny Cash, and Ray, the movie about Ray Charles. It sounds like a great idea for a film. Why did you want to satirize music biopics?
It's music biopics and also just sort of the biopic great man kind of movies in general. I guess I'm a sucker for those movies, and I go to see all of them like the week they come out, and you go, and there's always something to me kind of mesmerizing about those movies. A lot of times it's the music, and a lot of times it's, well, almost always there's a, well, really every single time there's a central performance, whoever's playing the guy doing sort of an incredible tour de force performance, the role they were born to play. And then there's also a way that these movies start to get sort of similar to each other that I thought was kind of funny, which is that namely, from humble beginnings, a genius emerges, spends their life wrestling with a childhood trauma, usually the death of a relative, their, you know, struggle that they're working out through their music as they're also breaking musical ground, fighting addiction,
right,
marrying, divorcing, fighting another addiction,
rehab, yeah,
rising, falling, yeah, rising, falling again. And I don't know, it was a moment of, it would be funny to make a fake biopic was essentially the idea, and it should be called Walk Hard, The Dewey Cox Story. That was the entire initial idea. I mentioned it to Judd Apatow, who I've worked with a lot and who's a really good friend of mine. I mentioned it to him kind of in passing, and he got excited about it and called me up a couple days later and said, I think we should actually do this. Let's write it together and go make it. And that launched this thing, which has been great fun and fun to do. John C. Reilly is playing the title part. We're about halfway through shooting. But this particular goofy idea has the funny caveat, which is that because it's not a real person and the genres that we're sort of playing with is completely dependent on the original music of the person being depicted, we had to generate a whole canon of his hits. So we've spent like 6 months prior to the beginning of shooting developing, writing, recording all this original music that John sings, 35 original songs that he's tracked.
What genre are they?
The character starts out kind of, you know, in the... Well, John plays the role from the age of 14 to the age of 80. and he... So he starts in high school, and, you know, it sort of follows him through the 50s, where he's kind of a Roy Orbison, Buddy Holly, Waylon Jennings kind of composite, which is a big, that's kind of a wide swath right there. But and then it sort of continues through the 60s, and he goes through sort of a political period, and then sort of a, you know, a psychedelic, you know, playing with orchestras and sounds, and, you know, through the 70s, where he has a television variety show and sort of tracks his entire life. So he's a cross-genre hybrid.
Oh, great. Good luck with the movie you're working on now and with the TV set. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks for talking to me, Terry. I love your show.
Jake Kasdan wrote and directed the new movie, The TV Set. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdock. Roberta Shirok directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Delacorte Press, publisher of The Year of Fog, a novel that explores the family drama that unfolds when a child disappears, by Michelle Richmond. From the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org. And from the California Endowment, working to improve the health and health care of California's diverse communities, and celebrating 10 years of community health and partnership. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
After 8 years of military rule, Pakistan's President Pervez Musharraf is facing public protests and appears unable to stop the rise of the Taliban in his country. The Bush administration counts Musharraf as an ally in the war on terror. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Pakistani journalist Ahmed Rashid, author of the bestsellers Taliban and Jihad. Join us for the next Fresh Air.